different great personalities that have been before him, Rupa Goswami, Raghunath Das, Sarup Damodar, Sanatana Goswami, they've all departed, and he's no longer any hope of association with them. What to speak of one of his dearest and closest friends, Srinivasacharya. So in this mood of separation, he's written this song, and he actually describes himself as weeping. Sometimes we become a little filled with separation at the passing of a particular devotee or a family member or a loved one, and we actually cry in that separation. I mean, to try and imagine the mood of separation Narottam feels in this song, and the distress, the spiritual distress of not having the association with these great personalities, or for that matter, even assuming to have had the association of these personalities, something so beyond our ability. So, anyway, just a couple of words about that song. It's a very interesting thing, the disappearance of Bhaktivinoda Thakur being tied so closely to the life of Gadadhar Pandit. The worshipable deities of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, of course, were Gadai Gadadhar. And if you go to his residence there, just outside of Mayapur, I had the good fortune of visiting that after not having been there in so many years, just this last party. The deities are still very nicely kept intact there and worshipped very nicely. And the actual room where Bhaktivinoda locked himself up and entered into his samadhi for that period of time is all still there and very nicely maintained as well. So although in one sense we see, historically speaking, Bhaktivinoda to be some distance from us, because of the maintaining of these places connected with his life, these pilgrimage places, we're able to feel that close connection when we visit them. This is one of the importance of maintaining the sites of our acharyas, just as 26 Second Avenue is maintained, just as the tree at Tompkins Square Park service is done there. So these are opportunities to keep places connected to our acharyas. There, as a reminder, there is a place where we can visit and have pilgrimage there and be reminded of these activities. Today I wanted to do a little bit of a contrast. We're all very familiar with Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life and all the difficulties and all the activities he performed, but one part that generally gets looked over, I was just discussing this a little bit, a couple of the highlights here with a couple of devotees this morning. They're like, oh, I didn't know that. And we view the writings of Bhaktivinoda so incredibly deep and vast, his teachings, and we're going to go over some of the instructions from him in his writings also, but there's another side to Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He was an extremely rambunctious and he wasn't exactly the most obedient student in school, let's just say that. When he was in his school years, at that time, of course, we know the history, his family were worshippers of his daughter Shakti followers, and he explains how during Durga Puja that there would be great festivity go on for 2, 3, 4 days like this, and everyone was dressed very elaborately, and hundreds, he says, hundreds of chandeliers would be hung from the ceiling and lights everywhere, lamps placed in all the different appropriate places, and you know, there would be fireworks, and the word he used is rowdy pomp. So lots of festivities. And he says then on the final day, there would be 25 to 30 Brahmins present, and so many different goats and buffaloes would be offered to Durga. Up louder? This? That? Is that better? Okay. All right. Yeah, I got chastised for that last class that I didn't get, I forgot. So on the last day of the Durga Puja, he mentions there would be 25, 30 brahmanas in the household there for the activities, and many buffaloes and goats would be slaughtered and offered for Durga. And Bhaktivinoda says, it was great fun for everyone except the buffaloes and goats. And he mentions that many of the so-called Brahmins at the time were there only for the taste of mutton. So this is a type of environment that we saw that was there in his early life. So in his later years, when he contrasts these type of things, we can see how that came to be. Now, in his early years of schooling, the word used is very clear. He had a very cruel teacher. This teacher was known for punishing the boys very strictly. But there was another side there also, that this teacher did this, had this exercise he would do amongst the boys, where there would be a type of a judge and jury type of thing, court proceedings, where the older boys would present some evidence and the younger boys would have to present contradictory evidence like this. It reminded me when my son was in the Gurukula here that they had critical thinking classes. And they would look at different types of subject matters from multiple views, not just, okay, the textbook says this, okay, next subject, but then analyze that. Because we know as we go through this life, particularly in the Kali Yuga that we live in, when people hear about our Krishna conscious philosophy or hear that we're following Krishna consciousness, their first impression is not to wholeheartedly embrace whatever we say is the absolute truth. So the idea of being able to settle arguments, to be able to present contrary points of view or deal with them, this is part of critical thinking, part of analytical thinking. So this was a practice that was there. And so the teacher did have that good side, but the teacher was also known for taking the ruler, cane, and slapping the boys on the wrist when they behave and act up like this. Once, on the encouragement of some of the older students, Bhaktivinoda Thakur stole a jackfruit from his home, Kedarnath at the time, stole a jackfruit from the boga at home to give to the teacher. This teacher encouraged the boys that they should bring things from their home for him as presents, so-called presents. Bribery, presence, whatever it was. And so, under the encouragement of the older boys, Kedarnath took a jackfruit. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with jackfruit. It's not a small fruit. It's not like a mango. Oh, you can put it in your pocket. It's quite large. So, when Kedarnath's mother found out, she became very, very upset and chastised him very strongly and said something to the teacher about it. So, the teacher said to Kedarnath, don't bring big things, only take small things. So from that day forth, he would steal some soaked chickpeas to bring. So, you know, in that way, anyway, the boys, the teacher was not very good at his service. And the boys became very angry. Actually, Haridas, one of Kedarnath's brothers, was so upset with the teacher and his cruel ways that he decided to take a machete and present the machete to the teacher. Let's just say it in polite words. Kedarnath heard of this and went to him and took that machete away from him, wouldn't allow him to do this activity. When the teacher came to hear that this had actually come to this point, he quickly resigned from his post and went elsewhere. He's never heard from again. And the boys got a proper teacher that took care of them and educated them nicely in this way. So regular daily activity in the school after this was that the boys would recite their different verses, the different mathematic addition and subtraction tables. They would each stand up and recite them. And, you know, they would divide it by groups. This group would start with the basic, and then they would build up to the larger numbers like this. And so In this way, they would go back and forth in this way. A little bit later, Cater and Oth, actually, when he was older, there was a French teacher. I don't mean in teaching them French, but a gentleman from France who was engaged as a teacher for the boys in Bakhtavinod's gardens, Bakhtavinod's grandfather's gardens. And the boys were very happy under this teacher, and you know, they would all joyfully pursue their lessons. And this is actually the way it should be, that children should be able to joyfully pursue their lessons. In these same gardens, there were different beehives, because, you know, they would use the honey for so many different things. So sometimes the boys, you know, boys get to be a little mischievous. That's the word I was looking for earlier. And Cater and Oth was generally a little mischievous in this regards. And the boys would steal honey from these beehives to eat them. Cater and Oth would try to restrain a little bit, but he enjoyed the honey very much. And the mother had this interesting way to see if the boys had been raiding the beehives. She would check them to see if they were warm, because apparently eating quite a bit of honey will bring a fever of sorts. And so the boys would come home and she would say, "Oh, you've been in the beehives." And so they would get chastised in this way. And Cater and Oth, Bakhtavinod notes that one time they were doing like this and the bees were not having any of it. So the bees all took after and stung the boys quite badly. And so the mother pointed out to them, "This is, you know, I told you not to do this, you know." So they had fever for several days after that, and they learned their lesson in not stealing honey from the beehives. You know, this is you know, just the nature of boys, you know, as it says, to get into trouble and cause some mischief. Bhaktivinoda eventually, Cater and Oth, decided that associating with these other boys was doing nothing but getting him in trouble. Smart lad. It's not common that hanging out with my friends is getting me nothing but trouble, so I'm going to quit hanging out with them. But he did this, and he used to sit with the gatekeepers, the chokidars, and in this way he would hear from them different stories from the Ramayana like this. And this began to be an attraction he developed for hearing these pastimes as opposed to getting into mischief with the boys. So this is just a little something there, even to the point that at night sometimes they would wake up in the middle of the night and go to sit with the chokidars and hear these pastimes, you know. So he was very fond of this activity, enjoyed doing this very much. I'm going to just stop there and move to some of his teachings, because as I say, most of us are very familiar from years and years of hearing about Bhaktivinoda, but this particular childhood pastime was not so well known. When my wife was discussing with me about doing this class, she mentioned that I should be sure and point out something I had already decided to do, and that's this writing of Bhaktivinoda. It's considered to be the last thing that he wrote. The 12 verses of my own self-imposed regulative principles. In his final days, this was the writing that he presented before going into samadhi. So I'd like to read these 12 verses. It may seem a bit lengthy. Oh, there's 12 of them. Do I have to sit through all of them? But yes, we do. It's very important for us to hear these things. No matter whenever and wherever I happen to take birth, let my loving affection and attachment remain unshaken throughout each and every lifetime in the following things: service to my spiritual master, service for Gauranga, for the detailed topics of pure devotional service and the methods of executing those devotional service as personally instructed by the Lord, the places of pilgrimage such as Navadvip, Shekhar Dham, and Vrindavan Dham, where all are blooming with divine sanctity due to his wonderful pastimes performed there, for the Diksha Mantra bestowed upon me by the divine grace of my spiritual master, for the holy name of Sri Hari, for the beloved eternal associates of the Lord, for the sacred days of celebrations such as Ekadasi, Janmashtami, Radhashtami, and the appearance and disappearance days of the great Acharyas, for the dearmost devotees who strictly follow in the sacred footsteps of Rupa Goswami, and for the holy scriptures narrated by Sukadeva Goswami, such as Srimad Bhagavatam. These 10 things he prays that birth after birth he will have an attraction for. And one of them particularly caught my attention here. Celebration of the appearance and disappearance days of the great Vaishnava Acharyas. This is an important part. These are not just randomly placed on our Vaishnava calendar. Today's the appearance or disappearance day of this one. No, that's nice, Jai Hardball. I've got to do the work. I've got to get the kids off to school. Celebration. This means some attention is given to. Whether it be our fasting or our reading about them or our having a puja like we've done this morning, some effort should be there on the appearance and disappearance days of the Vaishnava Acharyas to remember them, to share with each other their pastimes, to share with each other their teachings. This is one of the 10 essential items that Bhaktivinoda prays to have an attraction to. If Bhaktivinoda is praying for that attraction, certainly we can at least try to follow that example. Verse number 2. The Supreme Lord Sri Krishna is the personified abode of all divinely ecstatic mellows, and Sri Radhika is the topmost abode of all his divinely potent energies. Indeed, she is the personified form of the highest mellows of love and separation. Within the forest of Vrindavan, which is gloriously rich in the all-pervading treasure of sweetness, Madhurya Ras, this Lord Sri Krishna is continuously enjoying as he makes Sri Radhika happy by his loving service rendered to her 24 hours a day. This very same Lord Krishna is exactly identical to the son of Mother Sachi, who eternally lives simultaneously yet separately in Gaudadesh as the instructor of the process of rendering his own devotional service. May this Sachi Nandana become my spiritual master and guide, and may he always appear to me just to lead me on the proper devotional path, birth after birth. Here again, this is a very exemplary verse. While we certainly cannot place ourselves in the category of rendering service to Sri Radhika 24 hours a day, we can enthusiastically place ourselves in the category of praying to Lord Gauranga to always appear and guide us in the path of devotional service. Verse 3. Let no form of so-called renunciation or asceticism become fit for my acceptance if it does not give rise to the continual expansion of my eternal, loving mood of devotion. And let no form of so-called knowledge or intellectual cultivation appeal to me at all if it does not admit the reality of eternal individuality shared by the Lord and his devotees during their everlasting daily pastimes. I have no desire at all for practicing any branch of the Eightfold Yoga process, for none of them contain any scope for enjoying the daily pleasures of serving Lord Hari, such as his confidential worship does. Rather, may I render profuse, uninterrupted, confidential service 24 hours a day to Sri Sri Radha Krishna for all the time to come, such service being the means as well as the ends of my life. Bhaktivinoda is reiterating a point here that we're familiar with. It mentions that the performance of austerities and the performance of penances, this is quite important. Different types of renunciation. We have Charamasya. We have the fasting for the Akadasis, for the appearance and disappearance days. We have the following of the four regulative principles. These are different types of renunciations. But there are other types of renunciations, such as we're familiar with, described where the yogi sits in the middle of the fire in the cold river up to the neck. Bhaktivinoda says, let me have no interest in these activities, any of them, unless they develop devotion within my heart. Generally, if one does not follow the process of devotional service in regards to their renunciation and tapasya, then their heart becomes very hard. We see this sometimes in the personalities such as Durvasa Muni, very, very strict, but his heart, for the most part, we mean no offense to Durvasa Muni, the Lord knows we don't want to offend Durvasa Muni, but sometimes the example is there that the heart is not so soft in the performance of devotional service. So Bhaktivinoda is putting that, as well as the pursuit of intellectual knowledge. Oh, I know all the Vedas. I can quote all the verses from here. But if all of that knowledge and all of those quotations of verses does not give us an appreciation for the Lord and his devotees, then what is the benefit? As well as the performance here of the Eightfold Yoga process. We see that it's becoming very popular, that yoga is increasing in its interest throughout society, and devotees are taking up that opportunity to share that. But we have the unique ability to give something more than just the performance of the different types of yogas. We have the ability to give the understanding of how this can lead one to the confidential service of the Lord. So this is the root of Bhaktivinoda in this verse 3. Verse 4. May I continuously reside in a small, lonely cottage at the base of a desire tree in the most holy abode of Sri Vrindavan Dham, which is sanctified by the lotus feet of Sri Sachinandana. Such a bhajan kutir is perfectly suitable for constant remembrance and service to the divine daily sports that are always present in Brajadham. Indeed, in contrast to this, I will never live in any other place, even if it is hankered for with great enthusiasm by the most wise sages and demigods of all sorts. As far as all other places in the world are concerned, whether opulent places or temples, whether possessing vast riches of enormous wealth or princely kingdoms and property, all such places cannot attract me as much as a modest bhajan kutir in Sri Navadvip does. This speaks for itself. I think I can speak a little generally here. Many of us are hankering for just a simple thatched hut at the base of a tree in the Dham to live there. We may hope to come to that platform, but we're perfectly satisfied in our 3-2s here in Alachua. For those of you that don't, that's 3-bedroom, 2-bath. We're perfectly satisfied with that here. So unfortunately, that is our state of affairs, text 5. I have no attachment at all to any of the caste divisions of society, such as Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Sudra. And I certainly do not identify with any order of life, such as Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, and Sannyas. I have no fondness or respect at all for the so-called piety of religiosity, or even for the so-called impiety of sinful life in this world. Not even the slightest regard for either. Instead, I truly desire whatever is practically required just to maintain this material body in order to facilitate my performance of pure devotional service. This is the actual righteousness that I hope for as long as this material body continues to exist. It's a very wonderful example of the prayer recited by Lord Chaitanya, finishing with the line, Gopi Bhartur Padakamalayo Dasa Dasa. We're not any of these different types of divisions socially or spiritually. That these are nothing to do with us, but that unless we have a fondness for practicing devotional service, for pure devotional service, as Bhaktivinoda says here, then this is simply wasting our time. So this should be the hankering and the desire that we have. Verse 6. My austere vow is constant devotion to the lotus feet of Sri Hari. In order to execute that vow, I have accepted the following qualities by my own endeavor. These are the qualities Bhaktivinoda accepts. I practice great humility in my dealings with everyone. I try to keep simplicity and purity prominent in all my practical arrangements. I maintain extreme tolerance in all types of favorable or unfavorable circumstances. I offer all respects unto others, regardless of who they are. I feel genuine compassion for all living entities and act accordingly. There are many transcendental activities which are recommended by the great devotees who are fixed up in unalloyed devotional service to the lotus feet of Sri Mahaprabhu. And these can be found and described in the books that are full of the imperishable character and pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Only such transcendental nectarian activities, being recommended by great devotees and practiced by the Lord himself, are indeed my own. This is a very nice verse to have cut out, laminated, whatever, and put up above our mirror where we're putting our tealock, or next to our sink in the kitchen, or with those little magnets on the refrigerator. I know everybody's got those in there. I don't think there's one person in this room that doesn't have little magnets with notes on them on their refrigerator. So this is one of those verses that's ideal to put there. The vows, the commitments that we should have in order to have attraction to the lotus feet of the Lord. Practice humility in all our dealings with everyone. That's very difficult. This other one, to offer all respects unto others, regardless of who they are. We might be inclined, okay, they're my seniors, I'll give some respect. Okay, I mean, they did some nice service, I'll give them some respect. But everyone? No, I can't give respect to everyone. This is the mentality of our crooked mind. You know, so to be able to embrace these activities here, you know, this is the example that Bhaktivinoda is giving us, and this is why he's produced these 12 instructions here. Number 7. I have no attraction for living in Vaikuntha, the part of the spiritual sky presided over by Sri Sri Lakshmi Narayana, nor do I desire useless activities of gross sense gratification in this material world. I will never cherish the desire of attaining the divine bliss of impersonalistic liberation, even for a second. Furthermore, there are many transcendental pastimes of Sri Hari that may be very purifying for all the conditioned souls, yet such pastimes will never give me any real happiness at all. This is because such pastimes are quite different from the transcendental ecstasies of Braja consciousness, being completely devoid of a relationship with Sri Radhika, who is the one and only fountainhead of pure joy. This is a very lofty goal that Bhaktivinoda sets for us. Okay, we can easily, okay, I don't want Vaikuntha, okay. All right, but this second part here, there are some pastimes of the Lord that are not even of any interest because they don't bring such real happiness. So Bhaktivinoda is beginning to go very deep here with these statements. This is beginning to kind of prod us forward to a level that we read about but don't so much think we can. Text 8. I now disown my wife, my daughters, my sons, my mother, and all my friends if they have no genuine attraction for Lord Hari, for his devotees, for his devotional service. It is definitely a great sin to accept foodstuff prepared by such non-devotional, materialistic sense gratifiers. Ouch. If I were to remain in the company of such persons, then how would the eternal perfection of Hari Bhajan ever come to me? So, very important point here. Interesting scenario. In some of my recent travels, I came across more than once where an individual, let's be fair here, the husband, had decided, I no longer feel the need to support my wife and children. I'm just going to move into the temple and, you know, devote myself to service. These are very nice devotees engaged in devotional service, the wife and the children. So Bhaktivinoda gives the standard here. Okay, if that's your mood, here's how you understand. Do the wife, daughters, sons, mothers, friends, do they have devotion for the Lord? Do they have attachment to the devotees of the Lord? If they do, there is no consideration of giving up their association. Because that association is what prompts us. We've all got the experience, we're all married couples here, we've got the experience of one spouse or the other encouraging us with remembering a pastime. Oh, I read this today, I heard that today, you know, in class today, that was said. This is the nature of a proper grihastha Vaishnava relationship. In this way, these relationships have no fault in them. If, on the other hand, what is the word he uses? Non-devotional materialistic sense gratifiers. Just the description of that for a devotee like makes you put your hands up. Non-devotional materialistic sense gratifiers. Who wants to accept their food? I had a situation at work the other day. I'd done something very favorable and my manager came and said, what are some different restaurants I could get you a gift card to so that you could go there, just a little thanks from our side. And I thought to myself, none? You see, Govinda's is closed. So, you know, this is the mood of a devotee. No, thank you. I'm not eating anything like that. Verse number 9. There are certain persons who appear to be very advanced in devotion. Indeed, to increase their service to the Lord. They have long rejected the evil company of those who are completely blinded by faulty arguments arising from so-called intellectual logic, those who are madly addicted to the fleeting pleasures of a dull material body that couldn't be worded any more beautifully. Those who are madly addicted to the fleeting pleasures of a dull material body. Beautiful. Those who are adverse and envious of Lord Sri Krishna, and those who are very fond of the inferior, distasteful concept of liberation as is cherished by the impersonals. Thus, they have favorably avoided all kinds of bad association. Yet, it is seen that such persons worship Lord Govinda without Srimati Radharani being present. This just shows that they're actually puffed up with excessive pride and conceited arrogance directed against Sri Radhika, who is herself the best worshipper of Govinda. Therefore, I will never go anywhere near such so-called devotees even for a second. This is my strict vow. If we're thinking for a moment, we can have access to Shyam Sundar without Radhika. We're just fooling ourselves. Bhaktivinoda proclaims it here very boldly, and then not only says that, but says, those persons that think like that, I take a strict vow, I will never have anything to do with them. Will not even so much as cross over their shadow. Verse 10. Passing my life in a simple, practical way, eating only prasad, food grains, and milk products, the remnants of Lord Sri Hari, his mercy, wearing only prasad cloth that is offered to the Lord, using only the pots and utensils sanctified by the Lord's exclusive service, I will thus remain completely aloof from material sense gratification. Living by the side of Sri Radha Kund, worshipping the divine couple with a blissful mind, the time will come for my body to die. At the soles of the devotees' lotus feet, who are themselves serving the lotus feet of the divine couple, I will give up my body. It's interesting here, this first part, devotees should only take prasadam, understandable. The second part, wearing only the cloth that has been offered to the deity, reminds me how in the early days the devotees would take their new pair of blue jeans and bring them before the altar and put them there. You've all read about this in the old pastimes from the early days of our movement. But this is what caught my attention. Using only the pots and utensils sanctified by the Lord's exclusive service. In other words, this is an indication here, we don't eat from the same pots we're cooking for the Lord. We don't offer to the Lord. I mean, the Lord has his own specific pots and pans and plates in this way. But then he concludes all this with the real goal of a Vaishnava's life. That when I give up this life, let it be at the feet. And he uses the soles of the lotus feet of the devotees. How much more better can a departure from this world be than surrounded by Vaishnavas? And how much more better if those Vaishnavas, by your begging sincerely, would willingly place their feet upon your head? No devotee will do that. But maybe if you're very fortunate and you beg, they will do that. And why is that beneficial? Because those devotees have placed their heads at the lotus feet of Radha Shyam Sundar. This is the ideal way to lead this world. Verse 11. There is a class of pure devotees who are completely expert and experienced in following all the instructions of Sri Sachinandana. Such a devotee incessantly worships Srimati Radharani exclusively, who is indeed the most worshipable personality, and who is deeply absorbed every day in relishing the divine mellows of Sri Krishna's association. The pure devotee of this caliber definitely performs his confidential worship wholeheartedly and with exclusive surrender under Sri Radhika. Thus, he always lives in Sri Rajamandala. I shall take the nectarian water that has washed the lotus feet of such a devotee and carry it on my head. Drinking it with great joy and with a devout heart, I will then happily offer my full prostration upon the ground to the nicest, most perfect way that I can. This will be my routine each and every day. It's interesting how in these prayers, Bhakti Vinod balances within the same verse those activities which are high above our capabilities, meditation and realization, with the activities that we can actually embrace. To think incessantly of following the instructions of Lord Chaitanya in the mood of his service to Srimati Radharani, and exhibit that this is something. But to take the foot wash of the devotees, to place that on our heads, to offer our obeisances at the lotus feet of the devotees, this can be done. This reminded me of one humorous story. When we were in New York in the 55th Street Temple, there was one devotee that was obsessed, very obsessed with getting the dust from the feet of the devotees. And the rest of the pujaris weren't having any of this. Come on, leave me alone. I mean, what devotee actively wants some other devotee going around touching their feet? And he was very expert. He would wait till you were carrying a tray and you couldn't do anything with your hands. So it became quite... So we told him, you've got to stop this. So he did. What he would do instead was take a bit of water and pour it over the threshold of the doorway and hide behind the doorframe. And then when the devotee would walk through and step in that water, then he would take that water and throw it on his head in great pleasure. So we laugh at that, and at the time we thought, oh, this guy's completely whack. You know? But in reality, we didn't know he was following the 11th instruction from Bhaktivinoda Thakur on his final instructions to the living entity. Verse 12. As a spirit soul, my natural tendency is to be eternally situated in the loving devotional service of Lord Hari. However, due to the strong power and influence of the Lord's Mahamaya, I have somehow plunged deeply into the fathomless ocean of material sorrow and grief. I shall transcend this world of Maya and go to the spiritual world only by faithfully following these self-imposed vows every day. And the only way I will get the strength to follow these vows is by attaining the mercy of the Vaishnava devotees of the Lord. May their causeless mercy and soft-hearted compassion, which wards off all illusion, become my exclusive friend and guide for all time everlasting. Here, in this final verse, he gives the secret. So we've been listening to these previous verses and like, okay, that's very nice, but I can't do that. Thank you very much. Wonderful subject to hear. Maybe my next birth. But Bhaktivinoda tells us right here how we can do it. It's possible. He admits that, first of all, we've embraced Maya. We've plunged ourselves into this ocean of illusion. But how to transcend it, he tells right here. By faithfully following these instructions that are given here. These imposed vows, self-imposed vows, as he says. Okay, great. How to follow that, though? He says the only way to follow that, to get the strength, is by attaining the mercy of all the Vaishnavas. Here again, Sadhu Sangha. The importance of Sadhu Sangha. Because, why? Because devotees are soft-hearted. And they're merciful. And by that soft-hearted mercy, they will give me their blessings, which will ward off illusion. So, this is the importance of these verses and the instruction on how to follow these verses. Bhaktivinoda is at the very end of his life. This is the last thing he's written before he locks himself up for those 4 years in samadhi. And this is what he has written as an instruction for himself, but as a practical guideline for us how to attain that platform of high devotional service. We hear about it from our acharyas. We've heard it from Srila Prabhupada. We read it in the books every day. But how many of us believe, actually, I can obtain that? That I can actually follow that? Bhaktivinoda is laying out a path here for us. 12 easy steps. AA have a 12-step program? Is that what it is, 12-step program? Yeah. So here's Bhaktivinoda Thakur's 12-step program to get away from material consciousness. Here it is. So we can follow this, and it's a self-imposed. Just as if one wants to be successful in this AA program, to self-imposed restrictions. Don't do this, don't go there, don't associate with these people, don't show up at that place. Bhakti Vinod is giving us a similar 12 steps that will guide us in how to very, very faithfully and seriously attain these particular goals. I had two other writings of Bhakti Vinod I wanted to speak about, but I look up the clock and realize, okay, that's not happening today. I think we'll just stick with that, and we'll move on to Gadadhar Pandit. Gadadhar Pandit was a constant companion of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from an early time, even of their childhood. His father, Madhava Mishra, and his mother, Ratnavati, they lived very close to Jagannath Mishra and Sachi Mata. Matter of fact, his mother considered Sachi to practically be like her sister. They would spend so much time in each other's home, and you know, she would constantly be helping her with things around the house and you know, dealing with children, and you know, so they were very much like sisters in this way. And during the childhood, of course, Gauranga and Gadadhar would play together all different types of games, Mahaprabhu's house and sometimes at Gadadhar's house, you know, playtime. We call it playtime now, right? So-and-so's got playtime over at this house or that. So they had their playtime in each other's home all the time. Plus, they both studied together in the same school. So constantly in school together and then playing together at each other's home. The mothers were just like sisters. This is just like, you know, growing up with your best friend, you know. Now, Gadadhar was a few years younger than Nimai. It's somewhere 5, 6 years, something like that. But despite any age difference, and it's interesting, when you're young, sometimes that age difference is a big deal. When you get to be a bit older, you know, 5 years older, 6 years older than another person, it doesn't really count for anything. You know, oh, you're practically the same age. You know, but if you're a young kid and there's a 5-year age difference, it's a pretty big deal. But in this case, it was no concern at all. Nimai could not stand to be, for even a moment, without the association of Gadadhar. And Gadadhar similarly could not stand to be without the association of Nimai. The Gauragonadesha Deepika, of course, is no surprise to any of us, identifies that Gadadhar was none other than Srimati Radharani herself. Mahaprabhu being, and Gauranga being Lord Krishna himself, it's very easy to understand how they were inseparable. Vasudev Ghosh writes a very nice song in which he confirms this. Lord Gaurasunda, who is beyond the purview of the scriptures, beyond the entire Brahman, and above even the Vedas, can never be known by atheists whose intelligence is dull. Lord Nityananda is his eternal self. Lord Chaitanya is Sri Govinda himself, and Pandit Gadadhar is none other than Sri Radhar. This divine couple who are present in Sri Chaitanya are a well of rasa. Advaita Acharya has prayed for his descent. Within, he is blackish, but without, he is golden. Thus, Vasudev Ghosh sings of the beauty of this divine couple, Sri Gaura Gadadhar, in whose worship he has been completely subjugated. He prays that he will desire to serve them birth after birth. Krishnadas Kaviraj confirms also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, as does Srirup Damodar. So, no question of doubt, and even, I just wanted to read Srila Prabhupada's statements from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He says in the purport, after identifying Gadadhar Pandit as an incarnation of Sri Ranta Radharani, in the Gauragonadesha Deepika, it is stated, Sri Krishna's pleasure potency, formerly known as Vrindavan Ishwar, is now personified in the form of Sri Gadadhar Pandit in the pastimes of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Swarup Damodar Goswami has pointed out that in the shape of Lakshmi, the pleasure potency of Krishna, she was formerly very dear to the Lord as Shyam Sundar Ballabha. The same Shyam Sundar Ballabha is now present in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes as Gadadhar Pandit. Formerly as Lalita Shaki, she was always devoted to Srimati Radharani. Thus, Gadadhar Pandit is simultaneously an incarnation of Srimati Radharani and Lalita Shaki. In the 12th chapter of this part of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there is a continued description of the descendants and disciplic succession of Gadadhar Pandit. So all of our acharyas confirm this, if there's any doubt in anyone's mind about such things like this. In their childhood, it's interesting because we were talking about how Bhakti Vinod was a little rambunctious. Gadadhar was completely the opposite. He was very serene, very patient, very calm, quiet. He was filled with solitude, and he was a very renounced child. Nehemiah, on the other hand, was not quite like that. He was always engaged in some prodding and some teasing, and you know, we know all the pastimes of Nehemiah Pundit. You know, they're all very well known to all of us. And amongst his students, his classmates, rather, amongst his classmates, he would engage them in meaningless questions and debates on the subject of logic, just for the sake of, you know, causing some uproar. And Gedalia wasn't interested in any of this. It mentions that he was not especially fond of this pastime of the Lord. And so he would quite often remain at a distance when Nehemiah was beginning these activities. But Nehemiah considered him his dearest friend and wouldn't let him get away. And, you know, he would chase after him and take him by the hand or the cloth and drag him into the fray, so to speak. And he would say, Gedalia, in short time, I will become such a great Vaishnava, Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. They will come to my door and offer their obeisances. Very bold statement. Now, Gadadhar was also very affectionate with Mukundadat. Mukundadat was a little bit senior. And whenever any Vaishnava would come to Navadvip, because Navadvip was the seat of study, so many, many great personalities traveled through at that time. So whenever any Vaishnava would come, Mukunda would inform Gadadhar, oh, so-and-so is here, we should go and hear from them. So they would go together and have the darshan of that person. So one time Pundarik Vidyanidhi was speaking, Shrimad Bhagavatam, and Mukunda encouraged Gadadhar, let's go to hear this very, very saintly person. He's such an amazing devotee. He's so knowledgeable of the Shastras. So they went, and of course I've told that story 163 million times, so we're not going to divulge into that line today. We'll continue on some other subjects. Ultimately, of course, the Gadadhar Pandit became the disciple of Pundarik Vidyanidhi. When Mahaprabhu went to Gaya after the passing of his father, his return brought with it the manifestation of Krishna Prema, the full blossoming of his mood of devotion, having taken shelter there at Vishwarpuri. And his life began to exhibit a new direction. And day and night, he was manifesting love for Sri Krishna, tears of devotion. And in this way, Gadadhar fell right into that same mood with Mahaprabhu. Also, flowing tears of love in these kirtans that they would have and sitting and discussing the pastimes. And this point forward is when their association was inseparable. They were always by each other's side. One day, Gadadhar came to bring some prasad to Gauranga, and the Lord said, in a very exuberant, emotional mood to Gadadhar, Gadadhar, where is that blackish boy who is dressed in yellow garments? Where will I find him? I cannot bear being separated from him. And saying this, he began to cry. And Gadadhar at first couldn't exactly think, what should I say to him? But then, with some respect, he said, well, my dear Lord, he's situated in your heart. And Lord Chaitanya said, oh, he's in my heart. And with his own fingernails, he began to claw at his chest. And he was actually tearing at his flesh. And Sachimata saw this. She became very concerned. Gadadhar reached over to try and stop him. And the Lord said to him, Gadadhar, don't stop my hands. I cannot wait for a moment longer being separated from Krishna. Gadadhar calmed him, grabbed both of his hands so he couldn't claw at himself anymore, and calmed him. He said, just try and be a little bit patient. Just calm yourself. Krishna will come to you at any moment now. And Gadadhar said this with such sincerity and such calm and resolve in his voice that his words alone were able to pacify him. And he stopped this. So when Sachimata, who was just a little to the side there, saw this, she came and she said to Gadadhar, my dear Gadadhar, though he is just a young boy, he's very intelligent, but I am frightened that when he becomes overwhelmed with these moods of love, that he cannot control himself. You must always stay by him and protect him. So, in this way, Gadadhar was given this service by Sachimata of always staying with him. And whenever they were seen, whenever one was seen in public, the other was seen with them. So one day, there was some discussion of some Krishna Katha at the house of Sukhman Bardas Brahmacharya. And Mahaprabhu was sitting in the court, in the house, inside the room, talking with several devotees. And Gadadhar was on the veranda. And he didn't want to enter into the room and disturb, because it came a little after they'd started. So he was just standing outside the doorway. And the Lord was describing different pastimes of the Lord. Gauranga was describing different pastimes of Sri Krishna. And there was a great mood of Krishna prema flowing throughout the assembly. And this mood enhanced the feelings of love in the heart of Gadadhar, and he began to cry. He was weeping a bit. And Mahaprabhu heard, said, who is crying? Where is that coming from? And Gadadhar tried to restrain himself, but he wasn't able to. And he bowed his head and entered into the room, and he said, you know, it is myself, it is I. Mahaprabhu said, Gadadhar, you are so pious, you are so virtuous. Since your very childhood, you have been devoted to Krishna. My life has been wasted. I have only come to develop love for Krishna recently. But due to my previous evil activities, I could not get the association of the Lord in my life. But you have always been in this mood. So, in this way, the Lord appreciated Gadadhar's devotion. After some time, of course, we know that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wrapped up his pastimes and went to Sri Jagannath Puri. And Gadadhar, of course, went with him. He stayed there, and all the devotees would regularly come and stay with him. One time in Puri, Mahaprabhu decided, well, I should note that when Gadadhar went there, he engaged himself in the service of Toda Gopinath in Jagannath Puri, and he committed himself to be the pujari exclusively for Toda Gopinath. He took what was actually called Kshetra Sannyas. He took a vow to only stay in Jagannath Puri and render this service. So after some time of being in Puri, Mahaprabhu decided he wanted to go to Vrindavan. And he began his departure, and Gadadhar came to go with him. And the Lord reminded him, my dear Gadadhar, you've taken a vow, Kshetra Sannyas, to stay here and serve Gopinath. You can't come with me. And Gadadhar, very clever, he said, Jagannath Puri, my Lord, and the deities of Jagannath Puri are wherever you are. So my vows to remain in Puri itself can go to hell, but if I can keep your association, I will get the same. And Mahaprabhu told him, no, it is not right that you abandon your service to Gopinath. Gadadhar again answered. He said, see your lotus feet, that is as good as seeing 1,000,000 Gopinaths. So he's trying very cleverly to argue his way out of staying and taking care of the Gopinath and going with Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu just said in a somewhat resolved state, he said, if you abandon your duties to Gopinath, you will be the one at fault, not myself. So Gadadhar answered, I'm willing to take whatever reactions on my head, but I cannot give up your association. So they went. Gadadhar followed a bit from a distance. They got some distance away to Katha and to cross the river and continue on. And Mahaprabhu turned and said to Gadadhar, he said, your decision to break your vows and leave your service has now become a reality. If you come, it will make you very happy. But do you want your happiness or mine? Very instructive statement by Mahaprabhu. Do we want our happiness or the Lord's? In this particular pastime, of course, there's a higher subject matter going on here, but the practical application of this instruction by Mahaprabhu, do we want our happiness or the Lord's happiness? We're busy every day pursuing everything we do for our own enjoyment, for our own happiness. Mahaprabhu is saying, you should want my happiness instead. It will make me unhappy, he continued, if you leave Puri and continue with me. You should stay in Puri and serve Gopinath with your vows unbroken. This is all I have to say on the subject. Now, when there's a debate going on, I was listening to a lecture the other day, and Prabhupada, the verse started out, therefore, Prabhupada says, when the word therefore is used, it means a conclusion has been reached. The conclusion has been reached, this is the point presented, that's that. So Mahaprabhu is concluding the conversation with the Godhead. It's as if he says, therefore. Therefore, this is all I have to say on the subject. Mahaprabhu has made his desire known. Now, it's up to Gadadhar to decide what to do. And what did he do? He fell to the ground in a faint. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya comforted him and accompanied him back to Jagannathpur, where he continued his service to Gopinath. He continued that service to Gopinath to a very elderly age, so much so that the ability to reach up and place the garland on the neck of Gopinath became difficult. Sometimes we see that as a person ages, their ability to stand up straight, to have proper posture, as we might say, becomes complicated. So Gadadhar was not able to do this anymore. Just see the loving exchange between Gopinath and Gadadhar. Gopinath sat down. Where do we have an example in history of the deity sitting down to accommodate the devotee? Due to the sincere love of Gadadhar Pandit, Gopinath sat down so that it would be easy to put the garland on. And if you go today, you'll see that Gopinath is still in that position. The only deity you'll find sitting like that. So in this way, the glory of Gadadhar Pandit was firmly established in regards to his relationship with Guru Gopinath. Now, Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written one very nice song praising like this. His, as I mentioned at the beginning, his personal deities were Gaur Gadadhar. So he recites, he writes, remember Gaur Gadadhar during the time of their pastimes. Meditate on Gaur Gadadhar, the divine couple, the par excellence of beauty. Hear the beautiful discussions on the topics of Gaur Gadadhar and worship them in the forest grove of Godruma, bathed in the light of the moon. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his disappearance day today on the same day as Gadadhar Pandit, his deities were Gaur Gadadhar, and his prayers were to always remember Gaur Gadadhar. So in this way we have this nice example of Bhaktivinoda embracing the life of Gadadhar Pandit and life of Gadadhar Pandit being an impetus for the life of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So we're a bit after, we'll finish there. And if anyone has any comments or anything they'd like to add, we can quickly do that. Otherwise, yes, Sesha Prabhu.
You said the room where Bhaktivinoda Thakur set himself up was at that house in Gojumadri.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the house is it?
Where the deities are downstairs, that temple, then just across is his home, and then upstairs, up a back stairway, is the room where he lived, and then right next to that is a little closed room with no doors, I mean no windows, and it's locked off, you can't go in it, and it's very small.
So it's off that room where the fan
and
the bed.
Yes, off his main room, that was like his office. They have in that office a few of his personal belongings. One of the first electric fans in the area. It's a stand-up fan. I don't know if it oscillates like the ones we have now, but that's there. And then some of his books and a few things like that. Yeah.
One point that you didn't mention, that was when Gadadhar could no longer accompany Lord Chaitanya on his travel. He stood there at the bank of the river, motionless like a stone for a long time. He couldn't move. So what is the difference in the mood in worshipping between Gornitai and Gaur Gadadhar?
The difference in the mood is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur understood Gadadhar to be the manifestation of Radharani. And as it says in that last verse, meditate upon them as the divine couple. We don't meditate upon Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda in that way. It's a very elevated mood. It's a worshipping Gaur Gadadhar is in the mood of Madhurya Ras. And that level of Madhurya Ras, Prabhupada mentions in Purport, that that is a very elevated level. So as some of the instructions in Bhaktivinoda's 12 self-imposed vows are a little above our pay grade, as one might say, we have to understand it, we have to know what it is. We may not be there, but we should understand it is something we can desire to achieve, that it's not illicit for us to have that desire, but while it may be illicit for us to practice that habit at this point. I have to finish up. Pop the microphone over there, last one.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. Back to Bhaktivinoda Thakur's last 12 self-imposed regulations.
Yeah.
One of them about respecting everyone no matter who they are seems to me a little contradictory to one that came later, that if someone worships without Krishna, without Radharani, he doesn't want to have like anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. Could you reconcile those, please?
Respecting someone and associating with them are not necessarily the same thing. Rupa Goswami explains that there's four ways that we associate with the devotees. Those devotees that are seniors that we take instruction and shelter of. Those are devotees that are contemporary that we open our hearts to and accept their hearts. Those that are juniors that we guide. And those that we respect from a distance. Doesn't say those that we talk bad about and trash talk them and all this, you know. But those we respect from a distance. So Bhaktivinoda is saying, yes, respect everyone. But later he's saying be careful who you associate with. So association and respect are a bit different. Yeah. We'll finish there. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Gadadhar Pandit. Thank you.